Welcome, everyone. I think I'll tell you just a little bit before we start about what I hope to do in this hour on such a vast subject, and a little bit about whatever qualifications I might have to do anything at all. First of all, hope that at the end of the hour we will come away with maybe a little bit richer vocabulary, set of terms and distinctions with which we can carry on further conversation and thinking about this subject. I want to really open up the issue of love and friendship in contemporary society rather than to attempt anything like achieving closure on it. My own background really is one in which I teach in an interdisciplinary college and have for a while taught a course with a title similar to this one. The point being that I don't think that the subject belongs to any kind of set of experts or specialists. In the course that I teach, we read a lot of poetry, we read some psychology, we read some philosophy, we see some films. In other words, the topic of love and friendship is not anyone's property, it's the property of humankind, it seems to me. And it's for that reason that the way I'll work in the hour we have ahead is to make some remarks, make some distinctions, invite interruptions, by the way, in the course of my making those remarks and setting out some ideas for you, then pause and invite your comments. And if you have none to offer, I'll ask some questions to try to draw you out a bit. And then once we've talked for a while, we'll move on to another set of distinctions, another set of ideas on the subject, and then more conversation and so forth. So that's the way I'll work, and I work that way just because it's the way I work in general, but because in this case, with a topic like love and friendship, we all, it seems to me, bring to the circle experiences and reflections and wisdom that we're better off sharing with each other than sitting back and listening to someone else. So I'm going to serve as someone laying out a vocabulary, putting forward some ideas, and invite you to converse about them as soon as I can get some terms on the board. Okay, so love and friendship in contemporary society. The first thing I want to do is to suggest that the Greeks were a bit The Greeks and the Latins were a bit richer in their vocabulary for love than we are. We use the term love in our contemporary culture to cover a whole range of sentiments, feelings, and attachments. And I want to begin by just putting on the board three distinct terms and say a little bit about each one of them. First one is eros. Second, philia, and third, agape. Now, I think some of you are probably familiar with one or another, perhaps all three of these terms. All of them are translated love, but they're very different from one another. Let me say just a little bit about each one, and then go into some depth on the first one, eros, and if time permits, depth on philia and agape as well. Eros, that's the word from which we get our term erotic. It's the root of the word erotic. And it, though there have been many different treatises written about it, has to do with some kind of desire. Wrapped up in eros is desire for someone, something, some good. So the notion of eros is that it's rooted in human need, it eventuates in human longing, and that longing can be directed toward many different things, but eros is the name for this desire. Okay? Philia, also translated love, is perhaps better translated friendship, and it is probably more rooted in human choice than it is in human desire.
That is to say, again, one longs for the presence, the friendship of another human being, so there is some longing involved. But unlike eros, which is often thought to be rooted in a desire over which we have no control, we're kind of overcome with a certain passionate or ardent longing. In the case of philia or friendship, it's thought that here we choose those with whom we want to be friends and whom we want to wish well. And friendship turns out to be then a kind of mutual well-wishing. That's one way of defining it. And it involves a kind of definite mutuality. Without mutuality, there can be no friendship. It's awkward to speak of my being a friend of someone else when they're either not aware of the fact that I feel friendly toward them, or they don't return my friendly feeling. It is possible to speak of being erotically moved by another, or drawn to another, or drawn to something, without there being any reciprocity. So philia, or friendship, involves reciprocity, is grounded in human choice more than human desire, eros grounded in human desire, and may or may not be reciprocal. And then we come to agape. That's the kind of love that those of us who are familiar with the Christian tradition probably know as well as any of the former two. And it basically is a concept that appears very much in the New Testament literature, especially in the Gospel of John and the Johannine epistles, beginning with the notion that God is love and that God's love is indiscriminate, spontaneous, meaning that it's unmotivated. God is him or herself good, self-sufficient, therefore has no needs, and therefore is not moved by eros, which desires something outside of the self. So God's love is spontaneous. God's love is indiscriminate, meaning that it isn't as though God chooses to love because of some worthiness in one or another of the beings or in nature that God loves. Okay? He maketh his rain to fall on the evil and on the good and on the just and on the unjust. And Christians are enjoined in the New Testament. When Jesus, for example, invites his disciples in John 15 to love each other, he says, love one another as I have loved you. And that means loving one another in an agapeistic way. Okay? So they're just tiny little definitions. We're going to get into some depth in a moment. Now, if you want to take away a kind of scheme, if you want to take away, well, now, what did what he said add up to? What was the kind of bottom line I'm going to give to you now? One way of conveniently mapping out a lot of what people complain about or criticize or worry over in contemporary culture is to say that people argue either that we don't have enough of all three of these. A popular song, what the world needs now is love, okay? Or W.H. Auden, we must love one another or die. So some people think we just don't have enough of all three of these. Others believe that we don't have enough of one of them. Let's say we don't have enough agape. And we have too much of one or the other. Some would say we've got too much eros, too much of this kind of ardent, romantic longing, oftentimes thought to be grounded in sexual drives. And there's too much of this, not enough of this. So that's our contemporary problem. Still others would say, look, what we don't have in our highly mobile and restless society is anything called friendship to speak of. How many human beings have close friendships sustained over time? And so basically one way to locate different critiques of our contemporary situation is to ask which kinds of these loves are thought to be absent from our contemporary society. Are those absences thought to be good or bad? and is the solution to our contemporary situation, to have more of one or all three, or less of one, more of another, et cetera. We could, in other words, when we open this up, as we will do in a moment, find that folks here are all different kinds of places on what our problem is with love in contemporary society, okay? So I've given you just a thumbnail sketch of each of these three. And before going into depth on any one of them, I think what I will do now is to pause, as I promised I would, and invite you to ask questions of clarification, or I think what I would welcome even more is if someone would volunteer from his or her perspective just exactly what they think our problem is. Not enough of one, too much of one, not enough of all three. How do you see the situation from where you sit? Yeah.
Notably absent in all three definitions, I think, is any mention of community. And I think that community belongs in there somewhere.
Okay. One way we could speak of community, and definitely include it, if we go back to either philia or agape especially.
I think what? Community is, probably affects eros as well. That maybe makes it healthier.
Just a thumbnail sketch. There's a theologian named Rina Nakashima Brock who says, agape stinks as a model for God's love because it's unreal and there's no passion to it. And I want to think of God as a caring God who's not just sort of spontaneously overflowing and, you know, doesn't really matter, but to whom connecting counts. And so the subtitle of the book that she wrote is an erotic Christology. She's trying to interpret Christ in terms of erotic connectedness. And the word she used for eros is not desire, but connectedness.
Which gets to your point about community.
Gets to her point, to Ingrid's point, yeah. And so what I was feeling as you went through that was, I don't know if I like any of those.
Yeah, they were pretty thin definitions.
Yeah.
They were just to get us started, right?
Yeah.
It sounds to me like she's saying that agape is not connected at all. It's just sort of there.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Well, I don't get that feeling from the word at all. I get more the idea that there's still a connection, but the point is that in the sense of agape, God loves us in spite of everything, spite of our problems and our shortcomings.
I don't suppose that her agenda is the agenda here, but her criticism of agape really is the whole idea of sacrifice.
Self-giving?
Self-giving and well, it's a complicated argument. Let's just drop it.
No? I think it's well said. I mean, I think she's not the only one who makes that kind of criticism about agape and would like to restore eros to a kind of place of primacy when we start to think of human relationships and even into community as well. In fact, it might be just good to pause and talk about eros a little more in depth just at this point, okay? And I'm going to do this. Instead of trying to give further definitions, I'm going to tell you a story, okay? And then we can talk about that story. It's really a story not originally with me. It's a myth. And I think it is a very rich myth and might prove particularly useful to all of us in the coming week as we think about human loves. Okay? This is a myth that the source is a comic poet, Aristophanes, who tells this story in a book called The Symposium. Okay? And the story goes like this, and it's in an effort to try to picture eros. That Aristophanes tells this story. Once upon a time, or in the beginning, there were not two, but three sexes. There was the female, there was the male, and there was the
hermaphrodite. Three beings on the earth. This really involved the whole cosmology because it was thought that the male came from the sun, the female from the earth, and the hermaphrodite or androgyne from the moon. These beings had a kind of peculiar form. They looked, and now you're going to have to come up against my limitations as an artist, but I've got to try to get you to have this image in your... They were circular. This is just two dimensions. You have to imagine now a globe, okay? And then they had, I'm trying to draw something here, however ineptly, where we've got basically two noses, four eyes. And it was a kind of Janus-faced head, face on each side. And this was on a cylindrical neck. And then we had four legs, four arms, etc. You get the picture. Okay? Now, these creatures, and in fact, the way to picture it, if you ever read one of the Oz stories and come across characters called Wheelies, these creatures used to locomote, that is, get about, both by, they could walk forward, they could walk backwards, and then they could rotate, like the Wheelies, move very rapidly in a kind of tumbling fashion. Okay? Now, all of these creatures had a particular problem. They became tremendously insolent and powerful, and they sought to be like their creators. Okay? And when this happened, the creators became very vexed at the insolence of these beings and were deciding then among themselves how to punish these creatures. And they decided, after first thinking that they would simply wipe them out, that they would basically cut each of these creatures in half. Like so. This would weaken them. They would be less apt to aspire to deity. They would be weakened, and they would be humbled. So what happened was, to make a complicated story short, Zeus bisects them all, okay? He instructs Apollo to turn the head on the neck inside to face the wound here that's created, and then to draw all of the flesh together here, Apollo, like a kind of a drawstring purse, so that you get a navel here in each of the two creatures, where the purse is drawn together, and so forth. And that's supposed to basically humble them, make them weaker, etc. Now what happens as soon as this takes place is that these creatures not only feel a kind of physical wound, that's actually kind of fixed up because Apollo does a very good job of smoothing out the wrinkles, reshaping the skin, and so forth. But what they all long for is their other half. They in fact go about the earth obsessed with one thing and one thing only, finding the other half, okay? If they were originally of the male sex, you have two men looking about, longing for each other, rushing into one another's arms when they find each other, and remaining in that embrace. Similar with the two males here, similarly with the two females. Again, if that was the original sex, female, you have two females now rushing around, longing for wholeness, which they find only in one another's embrace. And similarly, the hermaphrodite, which in this myth was thought to be the most peculiar and then weakened version originally, there you have a male and a female rushing around trying to find one another so that they can be whole and complete. What happens is that these creatures are so pathetic that when they find one another and fall into one another's arms, they remain locked in each other's arms and die one by one of starvation. That is, once they find one another,
They can do nothing other than remain in each other's embrace. At this point, Zeus takes pity on them and performs a second act of surgery. Originally, the organs of generation had been located here and here, and these creatures had reproduced, as the text tells us, like grasshoppers by jettisoning seed into the ground, and then it was fertilized and new beings sprung up. And after all the original surgery, the organs of generation were still in the back. So now Zeus has them moved around to the front so that when these creatures rush into one another's arms now, there's a sort of sexual dimension to their union. And that is satisfied fairly quickly. And then these creatures can go about and work and do other things and then reunite. In other words, they don't remain just kind of permanently locked in each other's embrace. Okay? Now, what's the point of the myth? The myth is that it tries to give you a story or a picture of Eros, which is defined in the context of this myth as a desire and pursuit of wholeness, or a desire and pursuit of the whole. That is to say, according to this myth, originally human beings were whole and complete. Then they became insolent, were punished, were cut in two, and spent then the rest of their lives rushing around looking for their other half, either the exact other half from which they were split apart or one very like it. Okay? Now, this notion's picked up in popular songs too. You've heard people who need people are the luckiest people in the world, and that song ends, I'm not Barbara Streisand, otherwise I'd sing this. Besides, I'm on tape here. But it does end, you were half, now you're whole, okay? See that kind of image? Half, now whole, in the embrace, in the arms, in the presence of another human being, okay? Now what's important also to see about this myth, because it's supposed to dramatize Eros, is that unlike our contemporary culture, which often thinks of Eros as kind of equivalent to sex or sexuality, it's a much larger and richer term in this myth than our contemporary culture often, not always, but often makes of it. The fundamental longing in these beings here, the fundamental longing is not a kind of biological drive toward sexual union. It's a fundamental human longing for companionship or for wholeness, okay? Eros now is the desire and pursuit of wholeness, not the desire and pursuit of sexual union. In fact, in this myth, it's only after these creatures, once they find one another and remain in each other's embrace, and this does not have a sexual dimension to it, it's only after that that Zeus, in his second act of surgery, moves the organs of generation around, and that union also has a kind of sexual and generative aspect, or at least a generative aspect in one of the three cases we're talking about, where the male and the female, who were originally the androgynes, find one another. Okay? Now, by comparison and contrast to that myth, one you're more familiar with is the great story in Genesis 2 and 3. And my favorite reading of that story is by Phyllis Trible, who's an excellent and very careful biblical scholar, and she entitles her account of that story, Genesis 2 and 3, A Love Story Gone Awry. And in that context, she talks about Eros as meaning the whole of life, the sort of life-giving aspect of that narrative. And her point, she doesn't compare, by the way, that story to this myth, but what I think her reading of Genesis and this story of the symposium have in common, or from the symposium have in common, is that the original human condition that needs remedy is loneliness. That is to say, if you look at Genesis 2, after the Creator finishes, extends a kind of prohibition to the earth creature, it's not good that the earth creature ought to be, or is alone, because the creatureliness has been established by the command, and now there's a kind of at least gap between the creator and the creature, and that one of them gives commands and prohibitions, another one heeds them. And as soon as that's done, it's not good that the earth creature should be alone. And then the quest for suitable companionship, and then the creation of gender. Again, the fundamental condition that needs some remedy here, in the Greeks it was brought about by insolence, or to use the term sin, they wouldn't have, but the problem is their insolence, which leads to the split. In the other story, it's that the creation is good except for the need for companionship. And so again, the fundamental need is for companionship, and I think Tribble is right in thinking of this as a kind of love story gone awry. It goes beautifully once gender is created, companionship is full, there's harmony between all of the elements, the natural world, the creator, the creatures, and then of course that harmony is destroyed by disobedience. But in any event, those stories might give us a richer handle on Eros, because they point to the fact that when we're talking about desire, and I do think it's proper still to talk about desire when it comes to Eros, that's the tradition as I understand it anyway, a desire for what? A desire for wholeness, a desire for completion, which we find with an other, or I think by extension it would be fair to say, in community. In those stories, the early community are just two, but that can be extended and radiated out further, and it seems to me be perfectly consistent both with the Aristophanes story and with the Genesis story. Okay, let me pause there and see whether or not those two stories, recalling one of them for you, telling you the other one, help to fill out a bit what we mean by, or might mean by, the erotic. Any questions, comments?
Just to add a further nuance also that I think is interesting in how Tribble deals with that, as I recall, namely an emphasis on the similarity. You know, I think we've so read those stories that it's the difference, you know, and that there's this opposite complementarity, and she, I think, really does a reading that it is that similarity for the sake of companionship,
right,
that is emphasis, which really brings, I think, an important nuance into that.
That's correct. Very much a kind of similarity that's found. You ask people, getting back to the details of that story, I do with my students, you can try with friends. You ask them to fill in the blank, they all think they know the scriptures. And when you get to the end, when the creator, just after the creator says, it's not good that the earth creature should be alone, I will seek a suitable companion. And then it says, and so the Lord God made, and then ask people to fill in the blanks. 90% of them will put in there woman or Eve or something, but it's not true. What's next made are the animals. The animals are fashioned from the ground in the quest for human companionship. I think this is a wonderful insight, by the way. It suggests that the way we still name animals today, when we name species of creatures, are in the proximity to us in a kind of taxonomy. So we're still performing that original act of naming in the quest of companionship and relationship. But the point is, none of the animals quite work out. I mean, a suitable companion was not yet found. And it's precisely in the likeness of the two out of one, through that radical act of surgery, because Yahweh is also a surgeon, just like Zeus, remember? Anesthesiologist, puts the earth creature to sleep, surgeon, and then out of that one earth creature come two, Ish and Isha, male and female, etc., and it's precisely their similarity that makes them suitable as companions, in the way that the animals were unsuitable because dissimilar. Well, it's interesting that these two stories from very different traditions still want to emphasize, when speaking of the erotic, this longing for companionship, and wholeness. And I think if we think of the erotic in those terms, we're much better off than what our contemporary culture has done, which is to kind of reduce this, kind of reductionist analysis of the erotic to simple and basic sex drives.
Longing for wholeness is because you had lousy parenting when you were a child and you're really looking for your mother or your father, not for the equal partner who will be the companion or the partner in life. Or partners, community.
Another good point. You have to avoid reductionisms, the simple one-sentence answer that explains a whole bunch of things. And too many contemporary folks are heirs of Freud or neo-Freudians who wish to reduce all human attachments to basically libidinous and self-interested, every love is a form of self-love kind of thing. And this is a kind of variation on that. A certain need we had in an infantile period is now being negotiated again and again in the adult period, and so we can explain all longings for attachment to making up for those deficiencies. Again, I prefer to think of those things as taking partial truths and pushing them too far. It's not as though there's no truth in what you summarized. It's the problem with heresy is not that heresy is false, it's that certain truths have been taken and pushed too far. Okay, any more on eros? Because there are some things I want to pick up on philia which are distinct from eros, even in this more capacious and generous sense I've tried to give to it, which I think are there in the texts. We are.
Actually, I would like to say one more thing on eros. I'm back to community. I'm sorry to keep harping on this, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that all of that way of talking about eros is separated from our experience of it in our lives in a way that I can't quite put my finger on. But I think that our experience of eros has a lot to do with our communities. And I think it has to do with what the media says is attractive, who we're attracted to. I think the taboos of a community affect it. I think that love gone amok and people who have sort of lots of lovers and feel cheapened by that, or who have extramarital affairs because of chemical attraction or eros in some sense, do so because they have lost community in their lives and they aren't centered in some kind of important way. I think that when people are in community, that their sexual loves grow out of that community in some important ways. And all of that is not acknowledged in that schema. And I'm wondering if there's anything to it or if I'm crazy.
Would anybody care to respond to that? Is your point that the character of what we understand to be eros is warped by the kind of commercialization of sexuality and so forth?
It's partly that. It's partly that I don't think that it is simply that I, as a human being, are suddenly and overwhelmingly attracted to one other human being in this world and leap into bed with that person and satisfied forevermore with that person, and that sort of individualistic way of looking at love is all there's to it. It just doesn't ring true to me. It doesn't seem right.
So that so much hinges on that the possibility of there being erotic dimensions within other community relationships other than that person that you are related to in a particular way gets blocked out.
And for some reason, love dies. Erotic love dies sometimes. And then you maybe go on to somebody else, or maybe, but I think a lot of the sickness that we associate with erotic love in our society comes from an inappropriate, I mean, it's appropriate probably for the people involved at the time because they are looking to satisfy me, but I just have the sense that it may come from lack of community, that we don't live in context with people enough anymore, that it helps us deal with being attracted to a whole raft of people. What prevents people from acting on every physical attraction that they come across? What helps people to deepen physical attractions with one person? What helps someone who is widowed or divorced or whose lover has left them to move on to another person? All of that, it seems to me, happens to us much more in a context, and it is not some kind of a, it isn't like two magnets in the universe that suddenly, you know, that's it. I think, and we learn to be attracted as we get older, our attractions grow, even physically, I think, to people who we have respect for. I mean, when I was a kid, I went out with some boy that I liked just because I liked his body. I just thought he was cute, you know, and I necked with him and it was great. But I was 16 then, and now I'm 47, and the same thing wouldn't work anymore. And it's because I have a context, I have a community, I know who I am in a place with people. I'm not just a physical being chemically attracted, and it just doesn't seem adequate.
I think that's right. I think one of the issues for me is whether or not Eros, even in the sense that I've described it, will get at community as easily as the other two kinds of loves on the board. That is,
I think a kid though who's likely to sleep with a different boy every weekend, some high school kid, if she's in a strong community of people with values, will be less inclined to behave.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. What I guess I was trying to get at with mentioning the other two kind of loves, just to talk about philia for a moment, and friendship, it seems to me that that comes closer historically in the way that the term philia originally arose and has been developed in the tradition to, in fact, it was used originally as a tremendously elastic term, much more elastic than we would use the term friend. It embraced relations between and among citizens. It embraced relations between parents and children, children and parents. It embraced relationships between teachers and students. It also embraced, in its highest and best and most exalted form, friendships between two human beings who cared for one another's character and well-being deeply and intimately, okay? The key, it seems to me, one key difference between philia and eros on this score is what the notion of intimacy means in the context of philia. Because we tend to think often when we hear the word intimate, our thoughts immediately run to the physical, okay? And surely intimacy has a physical dimension, but in the neighborhood of philia, the question would be, when do you think you are most truly and deeply yourself? And the answer within that tradition was, when you are thinking, feeling, and speaking. Okay? And so the most intimate thing that you and I could do on this reckoning of philia would be to share thoughts, speeches, and feelings. Not necessarily, though we may, share our bodies physically, okay? We tend to think very much that intimacy means the sharing of bodies, or at least that it centrally involves that. In this tradition, you were most intimate with other human beings when you shared thoughts and speeches. And this gets directly into your notion of community. The community was basically then a network of friends. And the best community was a network of friends who were virtuous in the way that you and I and most of the people in this room would, I think, pretty quickly agree to a kind of common picture of human excellence. And it was that community that sustained those excellences, such that each individual had those excellences, such that they weren't prone to do the kind of things you worry about young people doing, etc. So I really think that philia, which it seems to me is rightly translated love or friendship, really does, I think, get at your worry. But let's hear some other folks on that. What do you make of the concept of intimacy as being bound up with our thoughts, feelings, and speeches, as opposed to, or not, I'm sorry, not as opposed to, more than actual physical co-presence? Yes.
I guess that's something that I see a lot of feminist theologians getting at. I'm thinking of a book called Fierce Tenderness by Mary Hunt, where she uses, I think, tries to retrieve some of that filial friendship kind of stuff. But also others that have said that from women's perspective, intimacy may not always be simply or primarily in terms of physical closeness. And so I think there's all kinds of different lenses of, you know, that are beginning to emerge, beginning at that, and say, you know, has that way in which we, I think, as you pointed out, tended to reduce it to only physical intimacy, has that at all been representative of lots of people's experiences, and perhaps hasn't?
Mm-hmm. I really don't think that it's been that, I mean, characteristic of men either. I mean, in other words, I think the relationships that, I think part of the problem with men is that they have been as acculturated as anybody else, and they believe somehow that when it comes to establishing, quote, manhood, this has to be done in some kind of physical way. But as a matter of fact, those things which they find most nourishing and sustain themselves over the years and really do last and have a kind of steadfast and rich quality are also the sharing of thoughts and speeches. It's just that they can't, many of them, connect that form of intimacy with the other form, and they tend to compartmentalize them, see them as in separate categories. But I mean, let's hear from some others. I would like to just hear some reactions to the thoughts and speeches notion, and notions of intimacy that give primacy to other aspects of our souls than the physical aspects of the body. Yes, Bill?
I think in that case also there is a need for a sameness for this to reach a strong attraction of that sort. You don't just being with someone doesn't necessarily lead to this unless somehow you resonate to each other's thoughts and feelings and speeches.
Is that, there's an interesting hypothesis here. There's required a certain kind of sameness in order for friendship really to be durable. Birds of a feather type statement, as opposed to opposites attract. Birds of a feather.
I think maybe it can be opposite in many ways, but value-wise, the value system has to be very similar to have a friendship.
I know a personal relationship my wife has with a friend, and they're two direct opposites. And the two of them identify that, but like you were saying, the values are there.
If the values are there, then the thrill of discovering and celebrating differences all the more thrilling and enriching, it seems to me.
The two are real good for each other.
I don't think you necessarily need common values either, but a willingness to listen and, I guess, a respect of each other.
Respect and the capacity to listen and so forth all goes to this conception of intimacy that goes with feeling. Exactly.
And in all of these, there is a mutuality, at least.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a one-way relationship.
Has to be, and I think that gets to community as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has to be mutual.
Well, I know when you were talking about the male portion, I had a real problem with that a year ago, and I know it's my emotion. To an intimacy state within my family and my daughter. And there were a lot of feelings that came out of me. And I never really identified how serious it was until about a week later. I had to sit down and talk to the doctor about it, because I almost had nervous breakdown. And I was raised as, from Western Montana, I was raised that, you know, the male never cried. Came out of the 60s. And to be intimate in sharing feelings with another male, or even sharing feelings that were emotional, was very taboo. It's kind of a macho, the 60s image of, you know, the chainsaw redneck type person.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is. It, I tried to figure out what it was, and I finally identified what it was. It was all these feelings of raising this girl and this woman. And all of a sudden, it just came out in a matter of hours. And I don't think society nowadays has enough time for what you're talking about. In the contemporary state, we've cranked this thing up so fast. I've noticed some students, I'm going to school right now, and trying to put some technology back into my career change, or my career reposition. And I noticed some of the older students that are like 35. Most people think of students as, you know, 18, here I am 44, and I'm going back to school with 18-year-olds. Some of the 35-year-old guys, they're just looking back and saying, hey, man, let's slow this thing down. The ability to, what you're saying right now, I don't think society has time to be intimate.
Okay, I think that you're onto something vitally important there. Remember I said at the beginning that one way to locate folks on what's wrong with today's society is to say there's not enough of all three, or too much of one, not enough of the other, and so on. I guess I would only modify what you say. When we speak of society, I think there are real differences among social classes here, and I think there are real differences between Western industrialized societies and others. Others who prize hospitality more, who don't see folks dropping in as an interruption, but as centrally what life is about. Who don't identify themselves as so many middle-class persons do with their job and what they do, but with who their friends are and so forth. And I think within this country, in different social classes, and certainly in other countries, you would find more of what you're longing for and finding missing in our society. But all I would say is that we need to be careful in talking about it being true of all society. It's certainly true, I think, and here I agree with you entirely, with our sort of socioeconomic class. We just don't have the time to take a pinch of salt together, which some people have said is the minimal requirement for real friendship, or to be hospitable. And those virtues are absent, and they're real losses for exactly the reasons that you have said. Not enough eros or philia, because too much individualism, identification with vocation, being driven by those things. Thank you.
I think about something that's listening to Ingrid as she's trying to figure out the eros portion of it that sticks out for me, and is also true with Ophelia, is knowing who I am. Because I think within that search for self, we use different methods, whether it's communal, whether it's sexual, and intimacy, and the searching for intimacy through conversation and so on, is also a depth of pulling, knowing more of myself. And without a healthy balance of finding self within a filial kind of friendship relationship, or an erotic relationship, a sexual relationship, without that balance in there, there's still that separation of self. There's not a completeness in understanding who I am. I think the intention, or the result of separating those ideas within U.S. culture, has created a compartmentalizing for many of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think it's the necessity to draw those together again, to recognize the wholeness of ourselves, both in body, mind, and spirit, or all of body.
Let me just ask you a follow-up question for clarification. Are you saying that our problem is that we don't recognize the extent to which we find ourselves in the midst of community and others? And imagine this quest for self to be a private and solitary one? Is that what you were getting at, or? I was trying to understand what you were.
I think we have difficulty recognizing, I certainly do, at times thinking that much of what's happening for me is a searching for self. That at the age of 31, when I write home and say, what's happening to me when I'm here at Holden, is I'm coming to know myself more fully in my faith life, in relationships to others, in recognizing the gifts that I have. I don't think we are, let me put it this way, that in a culture, in a situation where we talked about the me generation, that in my faith formation, there's a sense of self-sacrifice, that I shouldn't be dealing with who am I. And so from that, there's been a split. As a result of that, I think there's also other splits that take place in finding out who I am. Whether it's in a form, I think that's true as well when you talk about agape, finding myself in relationship with God, or who God calls me to be in that loving kind of relationship. That too is not always, it certainly has not been easy for me as a good Norwegian Lutheran, to understand that and the goodness of who I am.
Mm.
Does that help clarify?
That's helpful. It gets back in, I think, to some of the earlier comments when I did the brief summary about agape. In other words, the deep critique grounded in lots of folks' experiences, but I think especially women's experiences about words like self-sacrifice, self-abasement, etc. The fact that in certain of the mainstreams of the Christian tradition, there seems to be no room for what Aristotle or somebody would have called proper pride. And so the whole emphasis on self-esteem as a kind of corrective to that sort of self-abasement business. Any other thing on philia? And get something in quickly on agape, which I can see will be a very controversial term to develop. What time do you have? Do you have 20 till?
I have another thing on philia, briefly. I promise briefly.
No, if you have another thing, we might as well just continue on with philia then. Go ahead.
My experience is that, as Catherine said, about getting to know yourself, the more I've gotten to know myself and the more self-confident I've gotten about myself, the more I've felt erotic feelings for my friends. And it's like there were huge high walls built around all of those feelings in me for years and years because it was much safer that way and I didn't trust myself or know myself. As I come to know myself, those walls have come down to very low walls and I feel erotic love and affection and attraction to many of my friends, my women friends, my men friends, and it enriches our friendship. It has nothing to do with my marriage, my monogamy. It is a plus, and it's an enrichment to my lesbian and straight women friends, for example. It's not threatening, and it is a wonderful thing. And I think it's probably a combination of philia and the erased eros that's going on there, and I think they complement each other. But it's undeniable in me.
Now tell me a little more, you or others who have spoken on this, what the quest for self involves here. Is it something that goes on in community, or is it something that goes on prior to one's capacity to live healthfully in community with an other or with others? That is, do you see it as a communal process or not? Or is it solitary?
The more I'm in community, the more I learn about who I am.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's... yes.
Okay.
I mean, especially when you're living deeply in community where you're not allowed, in some senses, to back off from that search. I mean, that's been my experience here for 10 months, where in the past, I could find other ways to avoid coming to grips with who I am. Here, it's not easy to do that. And I think community calls us constantly, hopefully, to be seeking out self, relationship to others.
But isn't there the paradox that it's when you can forget about yourself that you're really making the most progress and finding yourself, when these walls that you're talking about come down and you're really able to focus on others rather than being self-conscious, which is a very uncomfortable feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear you folks say this, because so many folks that I work with daily say things to me like, well, you know, I just don't have time to get involved because I don't know who I am yet. I have to get this or that degree, fulfill this or that life plan. I have to be basically self-sufficient and autonomous and independent before I can then authentically enter into the relationship with others. And this is males and females say this all the time. They have these basic checklists of what it means to be, and they use words like independent, autonomous, self-sufficient, whatever, as though one first does this, this is phase A, which now sometimes can run until they're 30 years old, the way they've got it plotted out, because they're remarkably systematic in this. I keep trying to tell them life will happen to them, but they don't quite believe this. And then, once they've established that, they are then ready to get involved in community. So, I mean, it's good to hear people say that the whole quest is a communal one, fundamentally, and that the whole notion that you can postpone this and commit the mistake made by lots of characters and lots of stories. Gods are self-sufficient. Human beings are human beings, meaning that, you know, to aspire to self-sufficiency is another form of the kind of difficulty that got, according to both myths, these people into difficulty in the beginning.
Well, I think it's pretty much a minority opinion. I mean,
your opinion?
Yeah, community, no. Finding self in community. I mean, speaking from a single woman's perspective, where you're dealing with, in this case, a relationship with other, with men, that's many times the response. Well, I don't have time. When I have all my stuff together,
right,
then I'll deal with relationship. And it's sort of, it's a sad situation. I don't think it's just men. I agree with you. I think society in general, at least from U.S. perspectives, upper middle class, whatever, the more we have, the more we are, as opposed to just becoming who I am or something.
Isn't that kind of a crutch, though? I have to get through all these, this little checklist type of thing. Isn't that a way of conveniently saying, okay, I don't have time for it? You know, because the human is a complex animal, and what you're talking about here, for to become intimate with a person, is a real serious exchange of ideas and values. I'm going to throw something out on the table, and there's going to be this risk of you hacking it up the way you want it to be. Mm-hmm. You know, and that takes time. You know, here we are, we can turn on the TV and we can see a life and death situation in 30 minutes that normally takes 10 years, 5 years, something like that, to develop a feeling for a person and have that person die. Mm-hmm. And it's so quick that it's scary.
Would you want to know one of those people that had to have all these things accomplished in their lives before they could enter into a relationship with someone?
I've probably met people like that, and I've never really gotten involved with them because I can't get over it. That's hard.
Well, listen, folks, thanks for being so attentive and for contributing, and I'm under strict orders to end after an hour, and I intend to honor those orders. Some of the people who issued them are here, so I... in order to make the community work, it's important that we adjourn now and continue this conversation in other contexts. Thanks a lot.
Well, we've got 15 minutes to find ourselves then before...
Yes, 15 minutes to find ourselves before we do something.